What will be the impacts of the secretive Trans-Pacific Partnership currently being negotiated in Lima, Peru? Is the TPP going to generate new skilled jobs and investment and re-energize the global economy as proponents believe? Or does the TPP and so-called free trade generally signal a transition away from sovereign democratic states to global governance under corporate rule? We will discuss these points with analysts in three countries: Council of Canadians trade campaigner Stuart True, Washington Fair Trade Coalition Executive Director Kristen Bifus, and Kuala Lumpur-based Niall Bowie. On today's program, Globalization Watch, Stop the TPP. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of May 16th, 2013. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. You can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of recent articles from the Global Research news site. Recent reports from the ground suggest that America and its allies are losing their covert war in support of the al-Nusra Front. In recent weeks, the U.S.-sponsored al-Qaeda-affiliated rebels have been decimated by the Syrian armed forces. Now that al-Nusra, an entity created and sponsored by Western intelligence, is being decimated by the Syrian armed forces, the U.S. and its allies are calling for the channeling of weapons and financial support to the more moderate, non-Islamist rebel factions. What these developments suggest is that al-Nusra rebels are cannon fodder. Washington, in consultation with its Western allies, has decided to sacrifice its al-Qaeda-affiliated foot soldiers who are now being decimated by the Syrian army. That was from the article, America is Losing Its Covert Syria War. U.S.-sponsored al-Nusra rebels defeated by Syrian armed forces, by Professor Michelle Chosadovsky, dated May 12th. The Basel Committee on Banking Supervision is closely associated with supranational organizations like the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, which is often called the club, the headquarters of central banks, or the central bank of last resort. All of the committee's documentation is centered around an incredibly simple ratio: equity. A bank's capital equals capital adequacy ratio. Kabbalists of the money world are looking for this ratio's magic number, which would guarantee the stability of the banking system. In fact, the committee is seeking to legitimize what is a crime. Figuratively speaking, this system allows banks to make money out of thin air. That comes from the Basel Committee and the Global Banking Mafia by Valentin Katasonov, dated May 9th and originally posted to Strategic Cultural Foundation. Exactly how many people were injured as a result of the April 15th Boston Marathon bombing? An official tally from the Boston Public Health Commission puts the number at an incredible 282 injured and 4 killed, including MIT police officer Sean Collier. On the same day, Reuters reported 264 people injured. In sum, the photos, videos, stories, and figures comprising the mediated BMB do not add up and suggest elements of a manufactured event. The inflated injury count provided by the city of Boston is not readily supported by existing visual documentation of the two bombings, where at most several dozen individuals may have been seriously impacted. That was from the article, The Boston Marathon Bombings Inflated Injury Tallies, by James Tracy, dated May 11th. by making a few subtle changes to a regulation in the U.S. Code titled Defense Support of Civilian Law Enforcement Agencies, the military has quietly granted itself the ability to police the streets without obtaining prior local or state consent, upending a precedent that has been in place for more than two centuries. The most objectionable aspect of the regulatory change is the inclusion of vague language that permits military intervention in the event of civil disturbances. According to the rule, federal military commanders have the authority in extraordinary emergency circumstances where prior authorization by the president is impossible and duly constituted local authorities are unable to control the situation, to engage temporarily in activities that are necessary to quell large-scale, unexpected civil disturbances. Bruce Afran, a civil liberties attorney and constitutional law professor at Rutgers University, calls the rule, quote, a wanton power grab by the military, and says, quote, it's quite shocking, actually, because it violates the long-standing presumption that the military is under civilian control. That article comes from the militarization of domestic law enforcement. Pentagon unilaterally grants itself authority over civil disturbances by Jed Mori, dated May 15th, and originally posted at longislandpress.com. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Global Research is an independently run media hub for news, analysis, and opinion. To maintain its independence, Global Research does not receive funding from public or private foundations. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Joining us on the line right now from Toronto is Stuart True. He is the trade campaigner for the Council of Canadians, and he's about to embark on a trade tour, a trade justice tour, that will in the province of BC, in which he'll be talking about some of the major so-called trade deals that that Canada is about to ratify. And is in mentioning some of the things that reasons that Canadians should be concerned. So, Stuart True, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Michael.
Now, they were talking about maybe we'll start with the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now, Canada is one of about 12 countries that are involved in it. Could you tell us a little bit about what the Trans-Pacific Partnership is all about?
Okay, well, I think the first thing, and you said it off the top there, the first thing we're trying to do on this trade tour is to talk about these agreements and how they're not really trade agreements. These are very broad corporate rights pacts, which is what we'll be explaining on the tour. The TPP is a lot like the negotiations Canada's underway with the European Union right now, which are almost finished. Very similar, well, in some respects, there'll be a chapter in it that looks a lot like the FIPA with China, the investment treaty with China. And these are essentially, as we'll be talking about in BC, they're essentially the rules, right? They're not so much about tariffs anymore because these have gone down quite a bit since the WTO and came into place in 1995. This is about the architecture of neoliberalism, essentially. It's about, shrinking what government does. It's about deregulation. It's about encouraging privatization in sectors that are currently public, power, health, these kinds of things. It's about empowering corporations to challenge government policies they don't like. And in fact, in all three of the deals we'll be talking about, that's an important, I think probably most important part of these trade deals is that the rights in quotation marks that corporations get to undermine government policies through these deals. Now the TPP, you're right, it's got 12 members right now. Japan was the last one to join, and before that, of course, Canada and Mexico were allowed to the negotiating table last year. It's essentially, this has been called the trade deal or the corporate rights deal, I suppose, to end all corporate rights deals. It's basically a WTO replacement designed by and for U.S. corporations, essentially. They want to replace the WTO as the main space where trade and investment and regulatory discussions are held. They want it to go beyond 12 countries eventually and have other countries dock into it. So you have to agree to U.S. terms to get into it, instead of even at the WTO, where there's this semblance of a democratic process in the sense that, you know, developing and least developed countries actually have some power and some influence over the direction of global trade rules. In the TPP, they don't. And so you have a U.S.-led, a U.S.-led negotiation, which is about seriously undermining the ability of other countries involved to develop sustainably, to create jobs at home, to regulate the way they want to regulate. And so that's what's going on here.
Now, there have been trade. There was an attempt at a hemispheric trade agreement involving North America and South America and the Central American countries. I think there's about 40 countries involved, called the Free Trade Area of the Americas. Now, we're talking about a different regional alliance here. Why these countries in particular?
Well, I'm glad you brought up the FTAA because I think that's a good comparison between the TPP and what's going on with the TPP. I mean, that was another effort by the United States and Canada to expand NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, into the hemisphere. And it came up against an impressive resistance movement, unified across borders, public resistance, which blended at the time with this new kind of pink tide in Latin America, where countries were seeing the impacts of these policies that were forced on them by the IMF or the World Bank. They were seeing that they weren't working. They were seeing increased inequality and poverty and indebtedness. So there was this kind of, the FTA was a combination, failed for the combination of those reasons. So what have they done? Well, the United States has now said, well, we're heading into the Pacific. And they're doing this for two reasons. One is to isolate China, essentially, right? So China is growing, obviously, quite quickly. Authoritarian capitalism is working for China, but there are elements in China, for example, these strong state-owned enterprises that the United States wants to see curbed. It wants to see that kind of alternative models for development stopped. And it sees the TPP as a way to enforce in the Asia region and across, also with a little bit of a, another beachhead in Latin America because of the involvement of Chile and Peru, for example, in the TPP. It wants to see that those alternatives stop, and it sees the TPP a way of doing that. So I think that's an important dynamic that's happening here. It's also a matter of, path of least resistance. I mean, these people, these corporations and these ideologues inside governments in the U.S. or Canada who think that this free trade model has been a blessing, they look for any means that they can to pursue more and more aggressive liberalization, more and more aggressive deregulation, privatization, clamping down on any kind of social policy that's designed to, improve all of our lives instead of the lives of just a few people at the top. And so this right now in the U.S. mind must be the path of least resistance. Let's try and get this agreement going and then use that to force that model onto the rest of the world.
Hmm. Now, as far as Canada is concerned, I mean, you've mentioned, so generally the I guess, erosion of the social sector and the ability for governments to basically bringing more power to corporations. But I mean, what would that mean in practical terms for Canadians?
Right. So Canada's had, Canada's had 20, 25 years already under free trade with the United States, 20 years with NAFTA as of this January. And the experience is not what we hear about in the news. In fact, what we've seen under NAFTA is, provinces like here in Ontario, there's been just the cutting of manufacturing sector. Jobs fled the country. The jobs that are replacing those high-paying jobs have been typically more precarious, have been lower paid. Canada's become, like a lot of developed economies, since they implemented free trade, has become more on the service side, right? So less on the building things. So the impact is on, I think, the quality of the Canadian economy in one respect. We've also seen Canada turn back the clock. So from, you know, World War II onwards, there were many efforts to improve the quality of the Canadian economy, what we're making. We were making a lot of things ourselves. Now we've gone back to becoming a bit of a resource exporter and a huge focus on mining and energy and oil and gas. And these things that are essentially like part of what we would hope would be the old economy. I mean, these are things we have to move away from if we're actually going to survive as a species. I think that's become quite obvious when you look at the information on climate change. So there's this downgrading of the type of the Canadian economy, type of Canadian economic activities we do. And on top of that, there's been a limiting of the kinds of public policies we can put in place because of these investment protections in NAFTA. So we've seen auto insurance companies threaten provinces who wanted to introduce public auto insurance. They said, we're going to sue you for, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars if you do that. We've seen no substantial new social policies introduced in Canada in 20 years. And I think that's a direct result of these free trade deals, which say you shouldn't be doing this. You should be getting out of the way and letting the private sector do that. So we don't have a national child care plan. We don't have a pharmacare plan that would lower costs of drugs for patients. Right? This has been the impact on Canada, and we continually get nailed by these NAFTA lawsuits. In fact, we're the sixth most sued country in the world under this regime, where a company can say, listen, I don't like that environmental measure. It's expropriating my investment. It's expropriating my profits. We're not being treated fairly. And we're currently being hit by about, I think, $5 billion worth of these lawsuits against things like the fracking moratorium, the moratorium on shale gas exploration in Quebec, or against the Green Energy Act in Ontario. So I think the result we've seen in Canada under NAFTA is we should be, you know, asking ourselves why we would do this again. Why would we go further down that path in the TPP? And now it's a long-winded way to get to your question about how will the TPP be different. Well, the TPP is going to, you know, it's not just going after state-owned enterprises in China. I mean, it is about curbing what state-owned enterprises do across the TPP region. That includes liquor boards. It includes public utilities here in Canada. So again, another push to privatize these sectors, you know. It's going to include an attack on supply management, an attack on Canada's dairy and poultry farmers, because U.S. And Australian and New Zealand farmers want to be able to flood the Canadian market with their cheaper product. And of course, that's going to put a lot of farmers in Canada out of business. It will undermine farming communities where dairy farmers play a strong role in a lot of provinces in keeping those communities healthy. So I think we're going to see impacts like that. And again, on the issue of drug costs, people might have seen in the relation to the Canada-Europe negotiations, in the States, there's big pharmaceutical companies that are pushing even stronger monopoly patent protections for their products and for the data they put into researching their products. And the overall result is going to be to make it more difficult or to make it longer before you can introduce cheaper competition onto the market. You're basically extending the period in which these companies can make more money on expensive drugs, and that's going to be bad for our health system, it's going to be bad for patients, and it's going to be bad especially for the developing countries in the TPP region who rely on cheap drugs in order to make their they rely on cheap drugs essentially for their lives, right? The people are worried that people will die if these the TPP goes through with these kinds of intellectual property changes in it.
Now, we from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, there's also the Transatlantic Treaty that's on the verge of being ratified, as I understand it, the Canada-EU trade agreement known as CETA. I'm wondering if there's anything particularly noteworthy about CETA and how CETA and TPP and NAFTA might sort of intersect and reinforce one another. Could you address that?
It's an interesting question. It's one that certainly the Mexican government has been asking, and people in the United States as well, some trade observers saying, well, hang on, if Canada and now the United States are negotiating with Europe, maybe there's a way to do a NAFTA-EU trade deal. That's a little ways down the road, I think. What's happening right now is the Harper government's in a rush to conclude essentially a TPP for the Atlantic, like you said. It's going to be very similar, almost identical in most respects, in the extent that it goes beyond the current kind of trade and investment deals we have to empowering corporations in a much more important way. Those negotiations could be concluded in the next few weeks. We might see an announcement that the Harper government has finished these CETA talks with Europe at the G8 summit in Northern Ireland in June 17. What we have to do, and part of this tour in BC is going to be talking about this, is just because they conclude a deal doesn't mean they can sign a deal. It doesn't mean that Harper can get this deal done, and I think it's important for Canadians that this deal not go through. Like we were talking about on drugs, it's going to include more monopoly rights, more patent protections for brand name pharmaceuticals. That's one of the most important European requests in this deal. It's going to bind our municipalities and our provinces. They're not going to be able to buy local anymore. And when I say that, I mean they're not going to be able to occasionally prefer to buy local goods, local food, local components in their power plants, for example. This kind of buy local option just disappears for cities and for provinces if CETA goes through. And it's going to have an even worse investment rights chapter than even NAFTA does. And we've seen this. We've seen the draft that they're working with. We have a February 7th copy, and we can conclusively say that there will be more opportunities in CETA for European companies to challenge Canadian environmental policies, environmental measures, than there is in NAFTA, and that there would be in the Canada-China investment treaty. This is something that absolutely must be stopped. And the involvement, the good news is the involvement of the U.S. in negotiations with the EU has sparked a huge interest in the European Union among trade activists to take a look at the CETA and say, hang on a second, I mean, this deal with the United States is scary, but we have the template here in CETA. We have to fight this. And one thing they're going to be fighting very hard is the investment protections. One thing in Canada we can fight hard because people don't like the China CETA, because they're getting used to, or they're learning more about how in NAFTA Canada's paying out companies hundreds of millions of dollars when they challenge environmental and other policies. I think that's something we have to be pushing back on very strongly in the CETA negotiations, and it will help us when we're talking and when we're thinking about how do we fight and beat the Trans-Pacific Partnership as well.
You just touched on the Canada-China Foreign Investment Promotion and Protection Agreements, the FIPA. Is there anything else you wanted to mention about that? Maybe something that's particularly should be highlighted?
Sure, and thanks for the opportunity too. I mean, the China FIPA is really, you know, something clicked in the public mind, I think, in Canada when that was negotiated in secret and announced, and all of a sudden it was like, wow, there it is, this treaty that's going to give China-based companies like CNOOC the right to sue Canada if, you know, Canada says no to a pipeline, or they say they want to put more regulations or environmental measures onto fracking, for example. You know, this is going to empower Chinese companies to really undermine Canadian policy and Canada's ability to control its resources. So I think I think that was a very good thing, important thing to happen. There's been some enormously successful campaigns, like hundreds of thousands of people, for example, signing petitions against the FIPA with China. There has been a motion in the House of Commons to not ratify it because it hasn't been ratified. And that's an interesting thing about this FIPA with China. It was signed, but it's not actually in effect yet. And so there is some hope that we can block it from being ratified. And so what's happened from all of this is a First Nation in BC, the Hoopa-Achusetts First Nation, has decided we're not gonna let this slip. We're going to actually challenge this in the courts. And they filed an injunction against the FIPA on the grounds that it will violate Indigenous rights. And they have a good case for that, because the reality is even if a decision a province or the federal government was required to take because of the responsibilities it has towards Indigenous communities, First Nations, even if it was required under treaties or under Canadian law, a company can still sue Canada for that decision. For example, we're saying no to a pipeline. The company can still sue and get billions of dollars out of Canada for not being able to go through with their project. And so the Hoopatuses have said this is unconstitutional, and they'll be testing that in court in early June. So I think that's something that Canadians can really try and tap into when it's happening. It'll be June. I think it's June 4th to 6th. And certainly we'll be updating people at Canadians.org about the case. We'll be following it. But I think on the FIPA as well, I think people have to realize that this is not a one-off deal. This is not simply something Canada wanted to do with China. We have FIPAs with dozens of countries. And increasingly, the Harper government is signing FIPAs with African countries. So all of these rights that Chinese companies have to sue Canada, Canadian mining companies will have to sue African countries when they don't get their way. So say it's a gold mine, copper mine, say it's an oil or gas project or pipeline. The implications are global and globally very negative for democracy and for people around the planet. So I think what we'll be doing on this tour is making the links between the FIPA with China and these other FIPAs, as well as the Harper government's very aggressive mining and energy agenda, which does attempt to kind of charge into other countries and dig up things wherever they want, however they want, and basically grab the spoils and run. I mean, this is essentially Harper's energy superpower agenda, and it is so intertwined with these FIPAs that we have to really be fighting them on a concerted, we have to be fighting all of them essentially at the same time.
Now, I just wanted to ask you one more question, because I know you've got to run in a minute, but I'm wondering at the political level, where the different parties, the Harper Conservatives, the government of Canada is obviously very supportive of this agenda, but what about the opposition parties, and what about provincial political parties? Are you seeing any opposition there?
Well, opposition, so in Ottawa, there's some people are, uncomfortable. There's been discomfort with the Harper trade agenda, especially with the CETA, with Europe, and the TPP, and there's been a lot of discomfort and opposition to the FIPA with China. To some extent, though, when we're looking at the European trade deal, and you said it there, is there a provincial role? Well, absolutely there is. The provinces have been there at the negotiations. They've been playing a much bigger role than they have in the past. Basically negotiating away their ability to govern in certain areas, and it's going to be different in different provinces. I mean, that's a crazy thing about CETA, is that at the end of the day, your ability to govern as a province, as a community, is going to be different between whether you're in Ontario or Nova Scotia or Manitoba or wherever. And that is very odd from a constitutional perspective, as trade lawyer Stephen Scheidman's been pointing out recently. But I think what we can do is, Ottawa might seem far away. I think people can go to their provinces and ask them what's going on. They have been at the table. They have been trading away certain policies. We need to know what they are. We need to have a say provincially in what the deal looks like at the end of the day. And I have no confidence that we can get that kind of accountability from the Harper government. He's proved that, despite his words about accountability in 2006 when he got elected, that's gone. That was all words. But provincially, there's, I think, a bigger responsibility for the provinces to come down and to say, listen, this is what we're trying to do in CETA. What do you think? And if people don't like it, they should be able to change it. And the period to do that is going to be between concluding the negotiations. Well, we can do it before. We should be demanding this right now and constantly. But if an agreement is concluded and announced, we have to go very hard at our provinces and demand that level of democracy and accountability to make sure that we don't get screwed by these trade deals.
Stuart True is the trade campaigner for the Council of Canadians, and he's about to embark, starting May 22nd, on an 8-city speaking tour in BC to build opposition to Canada's corporate trade agenda. Stuart, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. When it comes to feelings in the U.S. about trade agreements, a 2012 Angus Reid poll found that 3 in 4 U.S. respondents across all political affiliations believe NAFTA has not been good for U.S. workers, 2 in 3 think it has been good, not been good for the U.S. economy, and a 2010 NBC Wall Street Journal poll found 86% of respondents across class and political parties agreed. Outsourcing of jobs by U.S. firms to low-wage foreign nations is the top cause for our economic woes. The Washington Fair Trade Coalition is made up of 65 labor, faith, environmental, family, farm, student, and social justice organizations, fair trade businesses, and cooperatives in Washington state, committed to creating a fair, balanced, and sustainable global trading system. I spoke with Coalition Executive Director Kristen Bifus about the TPP as it affected Americans. Kristen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me and for covering the Trans-Pacific Partnership on your show.
Of course. Now, Kristen, my impression is that there's been more popular opposition to these so-called free trade agreements in the United States than we've seen in Canada. I remember, for example, in the lead-up to the 2008 presidential election, when it seemed like Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton were duking it out to see who was more opposed to NAFTA. And now President Obama seems to have switched gears and is aggressively pursuing this new trade deal. Could you maybe give us a bit of a sketch of how the American experience has been with these deals?
Absolutely. And you're absolutely correct. It was a campaign issue in 2008. And obviously Canada is also part of NAFTA, and we're in our 20th year of NAFTA. And so we have 20 years of evidence of how NAFTA has not served workers in any of the three countries. But speaking from the perspective of the U.S. and the, you know, massive loss of manufacturing, you know, over 5 million manufacturing jobs have been lost in the U.S. and about 45,000 manufacturing facilities have actually moved to another location. And what we have found is that it's even been in sectors that seemed untouchable, such as, you know, call centers, engineering jobs, computer programming. So people who, you know, 20, 30 years ago felt that they got involved in jobs that were more secure, different from, you know, the automobile industry or other industries that have seen losses with other free trade agreements, found themselves in a very similar position with job loss. And we feel because of the huge opposition to NAFTA, you know, obviously the stalling of the WTO round here in Seattle in 1999, what our government has pursued is these bilateral trade agreements. And so 2-3 years ago, there were three trade agreements, actually, one with South Korea, one with Panama, one with Colombia. And so with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, has been this opportunity to reinvigorate these NAFTA resistance networks throughout Canada, Mexico, and now also with, you know, 9 other countries that are also joining in to the TPP at this time. You had also asked about process, and part of the process is the problem with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So here in the U.S., Congress, you know, our elected government, the government of the people, where we have the most power, if you like, has the constitutional oversight of foreign commerce. And so technically, they should be the ones that are involved in negotiating this trade agreement to benefit the people who put them in office. However, what's happening right now, it will come up, we feel, in the next 2-3 months, is that our executive branch, and we only elect one person in the executive branch, our president, has asked for Congress to give them the power to negotiate this trade agreement, and it's called Fast Track. And what this means is that trade negotiators who are appointed, we don't elect them, they will do all of the negotiating with these other countries, and then when it gets to Congress, they can only vote yes or no. And so if they disagree with some provisions, they want to change something, they're concerned about something, they will not have the power to do that. So we feel this is very much about the our very democracy of who represents us, where our power is.
Mm.
So, and the fact that we also don't know what's in these trade agreements, this trade agreement as it's being negotiated, it's very secretive. Our concerns that we can concretely talk about are through leaked text, because the process is very much closed doors. And even many of our members of Congress that we have reached out to find out have found that the doors are closed to them as well. However, the doors are open to corporations, and there are some 600 corporations that have unlimited access to these texts. And so from the process point of view, we're very concerned who's at the table. It's not our elected officials. It's not farmers. It's not community groups that are being able to right the wrongs of past trade agreements.
Mm. Now, I know in Canada, Stuart True of the Council of Canadians mentioned the corrosive impact on established programs that were established since World War II. I'm thinking maybe that's less of a concern in the U.S. For example, you don't have public health care the way Canada does. So I'm wondering what aspects of the agreement seem to be resonating with your fellow Americans.
Absolutely. Well, this very much connects with a number of issues, both present as well as historical in the future. One of the big issues is looking at some of the roots of forced economic migration. And we right now are talking in this country around enabling some 10 million migrants here in this country to be able to have access to citizenship. And we are working to connect the issue of having migrants here in this country that are grappling with so many issues once they get here, but looking at why are they coming here? Why are people leaving their communities in Mexico, risking their lives, and leaving their families, coming across the border, where here they have no rights, no access to the political process, no ability to have dignity as laborers here? What are the root causes of that? And we track that to these trade agreements such as NAFTA and others. And then also, as our community groups are working on, safe drinking water, access to healthy food, consumers are advocating for the right to know food labeling, what's in their food. Are they GMO foods? Also, as you mentioned, access to generic drugs. I mean, this really resonates. As you know, the cost of pharmaceuticals in the U.S. are beyond reach for many people here. When you look globally, the access to patented pharmaceuticals, such as antiretrovirals, is out of reach for people who are making dollars a day. And with big pharma at the table, using this as an opportunity to extend the patents, we're very concerned. People here are very concerned. It really resonates, access to pharmaceuticals. And then also connecting our ever-extending global supply chains. So with all of what's happening in Bangladesh right now, fires and factory collapses, it's really reminding people what was happening in the early 1900s here in the U.S. with the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire and workers literally dying on the job needlessly because of lack of health and safety regulations for workers. And so that's really resonating with people here, recognizing that in Bangladesh, they're where we were in the early 1900s.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm reading from the Office of the United States Trade Representative website, and they're promoting the deal, saying that it will increase American exports and support American jobs. And TPP is the cornerstone of the Obama administration's economic policy in the Asia Pacific. The large and growing markets of the Asia Pacific already are key destinations for U.S. manufactured goods, agricultural products, and service suppliers. And TPP will further deepen this trade and investment. What's your response to that kind of rhetoric?
Yeah, it's this interesting myth that exports alone is what will help our economic growth. So not even looking at imports, And this is something, this is a number that is not looked at. And if you look at our other trade agreements, if you put imports into the equation, our budget, our trade deficit actually increase with many of the countries that we have trade agreements with. The U.S. already has free trade agreements with six of the Trans-Pacific Partnership countries. And if you look at the other countries that we will potentially be entering into this agreement with, if you look at Vietnam, for example, you know, the annual income of a person in Vietnam is somewhere along the lines of $1,400. So not a lot of buying power there. And similarly, Malaysia, not a very, the buying power of the average person is not very high. And then when you look at the other countries like New Zealand and Brunei, there's not many people in those countries. I mean, Brunei has, you know, less than 500,000 people. In New Zealand, you know, somewhere around 4 million people living in New Zealand. And so we just don't buy this, this theory that the Trans-Pacific Partnership will really enable an expansion of U.S. exports in countries where we already have free trade agreements. There's already goods and services that are flowing freely. And actually what we're hearing more about is job loss because of manufacturers, for example, New Balance, which is a shoe manufacturer here. They make sports shoes here in the U.S., and they're one of the few, I think they're potentially the only one that continues to be able to manufacture here. And they said if the Trans-Pacific Partnership goes forward and the tariffs go down with Vietnam, that the jobs that they have here, they will have to move to Vietnam or else they will not be able to be competitive. So we just don't buy that logic. The numbers do not add up with past trade agreements or with this trade agreement, actually.
Now, the TPP 17th round of negotiations is taking place this week in Lima, Peru. You are monitoring those negotiations. What are your expectations around those negotiations? What are you expecting to come out of it or anticipating?
Well, as far as the content on the negotiating table, that's something we don't have privy to. What we do know is that our allies in Peru have been organizing for months with other groups throughout South and Central America. And they're very much seeing this as a disintegration policy where Chile and Peru are part of the TPP and Colombia and other Ecuador are not part of the TPP. So they're very much seeing this as a new way of economically dividing countries in South America. So Peru resistors have invited parliamentarians throughout the TPP countries who are also questioning and have concerns around the TPP to come. And so they're organizing a number of different actions and street events that we're very excited and we very much are aligned with them. We had actions just this past weekend. We're having a webinar on Friday, which I'm sure Stuart True with Council of Canadians talked about because they are at the fore of organizing it. And it's this opportunity for activists here in Washington State and the U.S. and Canada and other TPP countries to realize they're not alone, that there is resistance happening in all the different countries, and that by networking our issues and our shared concerns, we can put collective pressure on our elected officials to actually represent the people's interest, recognizing that our past trade agreements have not benefited workers in any of the countries in which we have trade agreements.
Kristen Bifus is the executive director of the Washington Fair Trade Coalition based in Seattle, Washington. Kristen, I want to thank you very much for sharing these unique perspectives on this new generation of trade agreements. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
To get a perspective on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, from the perspective of Southeast Asia, we're joined on the line now by political analyst and regular commentator for RT, Niall Bowie. Niall, thank you very much for joining us. What is the incentive from
Malaysia, from where you're part of the world, what would the incentive be for people there, for your government to participate in this deal?
Well, I think we need to look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership as the neoliberal arm of the U.S. pivot to Asia. So we have all these countries in Southeast Asia that basically have more incentive to do business with China, and China is more or less a natural ally for a lot of these countries in the region. The United States, you know, with its refocus on this part of the world, many policy papers state the importance of Southeast Asia in basically counterbalancing the influence of China in the region. So that is what I perceive the TPP, to be. So incentive-wise, the promise is unfettered access to U.S. markets, more or less. You know, but if we look at the way the United States has carried itself, its character internationally, it is never in the spirit of equality and equal partnership for nation states. It is in the spirit of dominance. I think if we look a little closely at the stipulations of the deal, it is really to favor U.S. corporations, you know, your Halliburtons, your Chevrons, your MPAAs, and what have you. So I think as far as Malaysia goes, Malaysia has a history as a non-aligned country, and especially under the 22-year premiership of Dr. Mahathir Mohamad. Malaysia has very, very much been a country that has held steadfast to its own independent political and economic trajectory, and I think that's very important. And here in Malaysia, we have the political class, I think, getting closer to the United States. You know, the current Prime Minister Najib Razak, because it is a market-friendly country. There's no doubt about that. But I think from reading the mainstream newspapers and the party-owned newspapers, which are more significant, are the ruling party, I mean, are starting to become a little bit more skeptical of the TPP. And we're seeing that, from what I understand, the full implications of the text have not really been realized by many government officials. But in this country, we have figures on both sides of the political divide, within the government, MPs and what have you, and members of the opposition who have expressed great skepticism and concern to the implications that would come with Malaysia signing into the TPP agreement.
You're speaking about the Asia pivot, and with the military realignments that are taking place in that region. The TPPA is principally dealing with economics. It's dealing with, as I understand, it's really not a trade agreement. It's the only two chapters, as far as I understand it, actually deal with
That's
trade.
Right.
So. How do you see that, I guess, the whole investor-state apparatus interacting with this, or that sort of synergistic relationship, if that's what it is, operating between this agreement and the military, this U.S. military realignment in that region?
Well, I think quite simply what this, you're right, only two chapters of the 26 chapters that I know of deal with trade-related issues, the slashing of tariffs, what have you. Essentially, the TPP is so dangerous because it makes signatory governments accountable basically for two multinational corporations for the costs imposed by national laws, regulations, including your health regulations, your safety and environmental regulations. You mentioned the investor state. Well, the TPP is going to impose investor protection that will incentivize offshoring jobs, you know, through various special benefit schemes and what have you. Now, what is also important to point out that the TPP will prohibit bans on risky financial services. It will prevent countries from what can we say, pursuing independent monetary policy, like issuing capital controls. Countries will have to permit the free flow of derivatives, currency speculation, and other financial instruments of the sort. And if we remember the Asian financial crisis in 1997, Dr. Mahathir Mohamad spearheaded basically Malaysia's recovery from that crisis through kind of currency controls on Malaysian ringgit, which allowed Malaysia to bounce back faster. So I think if we look at some of these things, it is really meant to bring signatory countries into a framework whereby they are hindered from really pursuing independent policies. And it is not quite like the European Union in that sense, but it is moving in that sort of direction towards a bureaucratic kind of a control grid over these countries to sign into it. Now, analysts who are higher authorities than me on this issue say that the TPP is basically a move to create a higher judicial authority, higher than the U.S. Supreme Court, because it will allow foreign corporations to essentially sue national governments and tie them into the jurisdiction of international tribunals, which would be staffed by private sector attorneys, who hypothetically have the authority to order governments to pay cash compensation out of national treasuries to foreign corporations and investors if any sort of government policy that's new or existing hinders the future expected future profits for investors. So it is really a neoliberal overload, what we know so far about the draft text. Now, it's important to point out that what we know is based on leaks, and we only know about two of these chapters that I'm aware of have leaked so far. So what I know is based on the analysis of others who are higher authorities on these issues. But what you and I both, I guess, have to agree on is that it's pretty scary what's been laid out. Now, the thrust of your question I haven't actually answered yet with respect to the U.S. military realignment. Good question. As far as I know, no information has been released about what kind of military components would come with the TPP. But, I mean, there's no doubt about it that with the South China Sea issues and all of these ongoing issues in the region, the U.S. will be there to provide security for countries like the Philippines and likewise. And I think the U.S. is really dedicated to bringing about a situation where its security is required, or it will be it will position itself in a way to provide that kind of security through military bases, through increased military installations. And we see now over 60% of the U.S. naval fleet stationed in this part of the world. So certainly these are worrying developments, but I think this is the shape of things to come. In future presidential administrations in the months and years to come.
That in terms of what would happen to Malaysian sovereignty or sovereignty of other countries in the region, that what would you be looking for as being significant in terms of the way the government or in terms of the way the economy operates, whether we're talking resources or social policy, what would be sort of the main potential flashpoints should a TPP be ratified?
Sure. Well, the other ones that I failed to mention and the ones that are the biggest points of concern for Malaysians from what I can tell in the newspapers, one has to do with health, medicines and things like that. The TPP would extend patents and things like that. So generic medications would become less affordable, and things like that. So I believe the current Minister of Health has in recent times issued statements expressing deep skepticism in the TPP, and that certainly there is not uniformity in the government about going forward about with the TPP agreements and whatnot. But we don't have we don't have all the information. So the people in the government here in Malaysia are not really on the same page. And the other point of concern is how the internet could be stifled because we see stipulations in the TPP that would extend, or should we say, that would make exchanging digital information more difficult, you know, and it would also, I believe some analysts have pointed out that stipulations in the TPP would entitle or entail local police forces to give a higher priority to things like cracking down on bootleg DVDs and other internet file sharing related kind of mechanisms. So this really, I think, benefits the country that produces the most intellectual property, which is the United States. So if we look at everything in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, what we know about it now, I think it is clearly to the benefit of the 600 U.S. corporate representatives that designed the agreement. So, I mean, that really comes as no surprise.
So, finally, given the forces in play here and the level of secrecy, what are the chances that this agreement can be derailed, and where might it be derailed?
As far as the Malaysian context goes, we see, again, as I mentioned, no uniformity in the government about it. And I think we have Mahathir Mohamad, who's 87 now, who still wields a lot of control over politics, is ardently against the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He often blogs about it, and I think his words still carry a lot of weight in this country. And now we see the Prime Minister, who once spoke pretty optimistically, but always vaguely about it, now becoming more skeptical and admitting that there are kind of deep concerns. And again, if we look at the history of attempts to establish an FTA with the United States, they've fallen apart. They've gotten nowhere. You know, Malaysia does not want to be in anyone's orbit, so to speak. But I think if we look at other countries like in Japan, the previous Japanese government was flirting with the idea of joining the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We see under the Shinzo Abe government more of a nationalistic direction. And I think of all the countries, the Japanese folks are the most vocal, the most educated about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, mainly because I think it would affect a lot of the rural population, a lot of the farmers, and of course concerns of medication and stifling of the internet and whatnot. So for whatever reason, the Japanese public, more than others, understands the implications of this Trans-Pacific Partnership. But as far as my work goes here in Malaysia, I'm planning over the next couple months. Malaysia just went through a very tense general election, so I spent a lot of my time covering local politics and focusing on these issues. But now that the dust is starting to settle, I'm going to spend a lot of effort over the next couple months to make people in this country aware and to, if necessary, build a movement to educate others about the ramifications of this TPP, and I think at this point that is what people in the United States and all the other signatory nations really need to do. They need to make available the this information in their own languages, so people are at least on the same page. You know, I think that is really the only way that this can be stifled.
Well, Niall Bowie, I want to thank you for your time and sharing those perspectives with us. Thank you very much for agreeing to be on our program.
Thank you, sir. Pleasure to talk to you.
And Niall Bowie is an independent political analyst based in Kuala Lumpur. He's also a columnist for RT.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.